taking place in the historical collection of the Middleton Medical Library. Well, I'd like to start kind of at the beginning. When you first were a young girl, starting your education and considering various professions, you were a young woman in a time and a place when most women didn't seek higher education. What influenced you to enter college, to seek a career?
Well, there was never any question. I was the youngest of three. Our parents were both college graduates. Every person expected to go to college. There was never any question of that. And I can remember as a child, I used to say that I would be a teacher because my parents were both teachers. But I don't know exactly when I slid into the expectation of library work. I never got very far into the doors of library. My father had a large book collection. It was an acquisitive about books. I didn't make a dead set to be any particular thing, but I slided sideways toward individual decisions that seemed to make themselves.
You had started out as a German major?
Yes.
That was your original degree?
I had no particular interest in science. In fact, I had no biological sciences in college. I majored in German partly because I liked languages and partly because the head of the department was a long time friend of my father's. And so I took a course in, his name was William G. Beck, I took a course in Beck reading literature. I never regretted it because, aside from science, your mind teachers are probably the best tools you have. And I have never been in a library that had very many people who were even cataloged in German, much less the ability to comprehend at a reasonable level.
But when you first graduated, you didn't start working in a library?
No, as a matter of fact, I worked a year before I went to college because my parents figured I was too young, I skipped a grade. And then I worked a couple of years afterward to earn money to go off.
Administration
was, I don't remember with that administration was taught as a separate course. We had really very little on the problems that come up in administration, building, planning, say, budget, personnel particularly. And it was all bookwork. We came out of library school at that time, I think most of us, quite naive about what we would consider the basics of administration. Because most people didn't go into administrative jobs, they worked their way up.
Became catalogers or reference librarians.
Or children's librarians, a strong one, yeah.
Then later on, when you went to the University of Chicago, did you find that the program there was quite different?
Yes, it was. It was definitely a graduate work. We had a great deal more. We wrote more papers. The discussion, class discussions were good because there were good many people with experience. I remember the then librarian of this special collection in Chicago, who has been librarian at Oberlin for years, was one of my classes. She contributed a great deal in practical wisdom
to the classes in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. And of course, there were some famous names there. I had one, of course, briefly with Douglas Wables, Karnofsky, who was the man who taught the history, social history book. And I took one course over in graduate on them. It was really the basic bibliographical course for graduate students in history, European history. And I've been grateful for the background I received in all of those. And Dean Jocko was, of course, a very pervasive influence.
Uh-huh.
And I think he was one reason for my coming to Wisconsin, because he was a Wisconsin graduate.
Uh-huh.
He sent me up here.
When you first graduated from Simmons, then you came back to the Midwest.
Yes.
And started working at the University of Iowa.
Iowa State College. Yes, it was a Cal College.
Yeah.
And Iowa has a system with only three state universities: the former Teachers College, the University, and Iowa State. So they were able to concentrate their resources. That each of those institutions gained in budget and in influence, because they didn't dissipate their funds in a lot of colleges all over the state.
Well, was the job market good then, so you were able to choose to go there?
That was 1961. I think most, I know one classmate of mine went over to Harvard at $1,500 a year.
Oh,
I had worked as a student assistant in this library, but she started 2 weeks earlier, and he apologized. Well, I would have hated to be buried in the departmental library. I found it quite slow at the time. But I went out to Ames at 1600. Fortunately, I got a raise to 1700 something the next year, and that was my salary for the rest of my years there. 1931 to 1945. Nobody got it. This was the Depression.
The Depression, okay.
And if you had a job, you kept it. But I enjoyed my work. I acted pretty much as assistant to the librarian and did a lot of editing with it.
Uh-huh. Who was the librarian?
Charles Harvey Brown.
Oh, Charles Harvey Brown.
He wrote on circulation work at college libraries, for instance, and all these articles. I did a great deal of editorial work with him.
Good background for beginning library.
Yes. But another very good background, well, of course, I worked in demand. But I didn't realize at the time Iowa State classified all of their dissertations and theses, and that required a little knowledge about almost everything. So I found background, for instance, some knowledge of botanical terms, chemical terms, zoological, educational, the whole thing gave me a smattering of knowledge of terminology, at least, depending on many professions. And I audited some courses, for instance, the nomenclature and etymology and background, historical background.
So that was when
I
started
taking the particular development of science. I also did some reference work for the better day people. And just gradually hatched onto the idea that, well, I had never expected to spend my whole life in the plains of Iowa.
So you actually thought of it and chose to go into medical library work.
I just drifted into it.
I think everybody does. Oh, gosh. So then that was when you chose to leave Iowa and go back to graduate.
Well, I had gone back. I'd gone one summer for my vacation.
To Chicago?
Yes. One other quarter, and then went 2 quarters. Yes. By that time, I was getting rather fatigued. I was really rather bored for the job. But it was just at work. Brown was a very active gentleman. And I assisted with a lot of his statistical work and the writing. I was familiar with other association activities. And of course, he was co-chairman with Eileen Cunningham, who was the German Periodicals Committee. He was very active in bringing down these temporarily the prices of German periodicals.
So then, had you met Eileen Cunningham at that point? So there was an early point of contact,
yes,
with medical.
Yes.
My branch.
And at some point in there, I don't know just what it was. I had the feeling it was an AOA midwinter meeting. But I can remember after the meeting that Eileen Cunningham and Marguerite Prime and a few other people were talking about recruitment. And I mentioned I had had breakfast at the table with some other librarians that morning, and I was impressed by one of them. So I don't know whether I started her on her association career, but at least I thought it would help if she was appointed to something shortly after.
Oh, that's interesting. So you were active in ALA then?
Yes.
In those early years, too?
We usually went to midwinter meetings, which was very convenient from Iowa. And there were
was it in Chicago then?
Yes, it was always in Chicago. And there was much more program content in midwinter in those days.
Was that how you chose to go start going to summer school in those quarters at Chicago? You chose because you'd already were familiar with the city?
No, I knew a good deal about the faculty there, and Francis Henney was a good friend of one of our staff members. When I was talking about, I was thinking perhaps of Michigan, and she said, well, why don't you come to Chicago? Well, I had always felt that Chicago being a strong graduate school was a little high power for me, but I did go there, and I never regretted it.
Had you entered a program to get a further degree, or were you just taking courses?
It was a master's program. But I came up here in the middle of April after I finished the 2 semesters without having written my thesis. I never wrote that thesis, and nobody here worried about it. I was too busy to
worry about it. Are you here to join the ranks and hundreds?
I have the bachelor's degree and the coursework. And even then, I was concerned with the interlibrary loan of the Chicago libraries. And the University of Chicago, of course, had a tremendous interlibrary loan. I was interested in where the requests came from, and where they were, and the kinds of material requests. And that's where I met Wilma Traxel. Here I was, just a grubby student coming in, and she took, of course, Illinois had a very grubby library at that time. As you know, for many years, they were even worse off than we were in Madison. But they took me in, and I remember having a birthday cake with them one day, and I've always respected that library because of their generosity and kindness.
So in a way, they served a mentor role.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yes, that's before I had accepted offered the job here.
Did you, while you were a student at Chicago, did you work part-time in the library or anything?
I did get a tuition fellowship.
So you were going to school full-time?
No, here, you remember, this was at a salary of, I think, $1,750.
Uh-huh.
Of course, I had more money than I have had ever. It wasn't until I got the year I came up here that I finally received more than $2,000. They made an arrangement for an annuity system, and then the additional money was the only thing anyway.
Well, how is it that you came up here? Was there... did they recruit you?
Yes, they recruited me.
And you said before he was from Wisconsin.
Yes.
And did you know at that time Gladys Ramsey?
No.
Had been the librarian?
No, she had been for 7 years. She went to library school when she got her degree. She accepted a job. I think that's when she went to MIT. And another staff member was a librarian briefly for a couple of years. Left. So
that
I came in after her. But I was the first academic appointment.
Okay. The one in between, that must have been Esther Gerling?
Yes, Esther Gerling.
So they recruited you, and the dean sent you up here. Okay. There was another name that I found in the old book, Mrs. Minnie Lowenhart?
Levenhart, yes.
Levenhart?
Her husband had been the head of pharmacology, and was quite a noted pharmacologist, and a very charming person. So she had been in the circulation library for years. She was a little person, knew everybody in the medical school, was, I think, rather distrustful of the catalog, but she knew every book in the library. And alumni coming back still ask about it.
So when you first came, there were two of you?
There was a librarian, a trained librarian, running the medical library service, which was an extension of the department. And she did what reference work there was. But we were distributed. We had, the library was kind of afterthought, because when they built that building with leftover funds from the veterans' bonus, I think it was, in the First World War, they discovered they needed physical therapy. So this central library area was taking all of the physical therapy, and the library was put on the periphery with a corridor down the middle. So we were broken into pieces, stairwells in between, and we gradually herniated out into every available space. We took over first a piece of the lobby. The doctor architect came as a professor of history of medicine, and then we eventually moved into that office. Herniated out into the rest of the lobby. We took over a classroom upstairs. It was just a fight against space over many, many years.
Was Dr. Middleton dean then?
He was dean, but he was on leave. He was chief medical consultant for the European Army in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Walter Meek interviewed me. And he was a bland, well, with a meek-looking old man, but shrewd. I don't think he missed anything. I was here a couple of years before Dr. Middleton
came back. Okay. A lot of librarians seem to move around during their career, but you have always remained here.
Well, it's always been my feeling. I remember a colleague commenting that it didn't pay to bribe people. I accept jobs because I like the job and want to do them.
Uh-huh.
And I can't think of any other place in the country that would give me more what I wanted. I like a temperate climate. I like the physical advantages to Madison. I like the south, the size of the city. And also the atmosphere in here is unusually cooperative. You know, the type of comment that is often made in institutions, the sneering comments of the scientists for the liberal arts people or for the education people and so on. I don't think that exists so much here, because there's always been a great deal of cross-cultural interchange.
since the Yai campus, my accident of Babcock, and a few of these early faculty members, had developed a big biochemistry department, medical school, and the Ag school have always worked very closely together.
That's not typical, is it?
Microbiology also, medical microbiology, and worked very closely together.
Hmm.
And
so you've always just found this a very warm, nurturing
place.
And I
liked being on the same, the medical school being on the same campus with the university, because there certainly is an enrichment that you don't find in one of these big city institutions divorced from its main campus.
Okay. I was very curious about that point. I think I understand.
You're in much the same situation.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It rings some familiar notes to me. You mentioned the library when you first came and was kind of burgeoning and spreading out everywhere.
at the time I came, it had just come to the point where it was no longer a nice little cozy, comfortable, small medical school. Research funds were somewhat in the future, but still this was a major research institution, and not just a medical school, a teaching school for medical students. And we simply are the demands, the needs, and the willingness to support the library was there too, but we simply couldn't take on staff because we had no place to put them. There were many things we couldn't do for lack of space.
What was the collection size?
Well, the AMA directory at that time, I believe it was 40,000, but I did an inventory and found it was considerably more than that. But it was perhaps 50,000.
Mm-hmm.
We had a large collection of unbound journals for our extension work, which were really they were single sets. They were not duplicates, but they were used like a bound collection. Of course, we had this 2,000 volume William Snow Miller library, which the medical school had bought after his death.
Those
were uncatalogued, but that was there were historical things in the collection before that was added, but that really was the basis of our interest.
The patrons that you had at that time, then they was mostly limited to the medical school and the medical students.
Well, it was our journals, of course, were used by people from all over campus, as they still are. This is definitely a university library and not just a medical school library.
Was there a large clientele then, a large circulation?
I don't recall what it was. I started keeping a record of a number of these things. We hadn't had a record of acquisitions or record of circulation. And it was considerable. It was a busy library, but our seating space was terribly limited.
How did those conditions affect your practice of librarianship at that period? It must have been very different than what you had at Iowa or libraries.
Yes, I was used to a larger institution where you added something to a typist or dictated something to a secretary. And I had no office typing except assistance. And so here I was with the student typist over on the windowsill, right, if I keep it to death. And anything there wasn't space for back then on me. So it was physically very hampering. I had a graduate student working for me once, and she was rather precise. She said she had learned one thing from that experience, that you could be orderly without being tight.
Great, that's a backhand compliment.
Yes. I think it was good for her, but of course she was good for me too.
Were you doing mostly what you would consider administrative things then, or in those early years did you have tours of duty on the reference desk catalog?
I tried to have a tour of duty on the desk, but I finally gave that up because I couldn't be sure enough of the time. But we always always did our own book selection, but the others had to go over to the main library. And we had, we prepared our own binding. The Extension Service, of course, had been active for some years at that time. So there really wasn't too much of a problem of administration, because there were only the three full-time staff members and plus student assistants.
And then, of course, after the war, your library began to change and grow, much like all across the country.
I can remember at the time when Hal Bloomquist called to ask, this was at the time we were pushing for federal funds to as a basis for all the service to all these research groups. He called and asked, well, how much more money would you use if you had it? Just automatically, I said, we could use twice as much. And I believe that was the answer throughout the country.
What kind of changes then did you initiate?
Oh dear.
Did more staff come first? Or did you begin working on a new building then?
Well, we had several spurts working on buildings. First, we were going to expand in the medical science building that was contiguous to the library. But their funds were split. Half was given to anatomy and half was given to medical science. And a friend of mine was much wiser than I would have been at that time. He felt they shouldn't put the library in there because it wouldn't be big enough. But it was a disappointment at the time. But it turned out to have been wise, because we would have acquired just about enough to serve our then needs. No possibility of expansion. And then when we started planning the building, first they changed the site, and then they changed the, turned the building around, and then they did another change, and then they changed architects. So that building never came off the ground. It would have been an interesting building too. So finally the alumni organized to build the building, because Dr. Middleton wanted it. One of them said that they thought he had holes in his head, but if he wanted a library, they'd get him a library. So they collected $250,000, which doesn't seem much under today's standards. But the legislature then gave $100,000. That's how this building happened to be built.
So it took you about 15 years to get the building finally?
Well, we really started thinking about the building about almost as soon as I came. So it took
that was in 46. Was it?
46, yeah. 45.
45.
Spring of 45.
Do you think that being relatively isolated here in the Midwest made this library develop in a different pace or in different ways than other libraries?
I wouldn't say that it did. Our staff have always taken interest in the national picture. We attended the regional groups. I think probably we approached it a little more freshly than the Eastern, because we weren't so much bound down by it. We've always done it that way. And that is a red flag to me. I can remember a discussion one time years ago with Mrs. Marshall about service to the public, which of course now be considered patient education. And she was very firm on this mother knows best attitude, which again puts me back up. You have to have some controls and use some judgment, but I don't believe in an absolute prohibition of anything. Because very often what you need to do, you can do. And rigid rules are often self-protective rather than promotional for the library service.
When you first came here and started out, the new MLA handbook had been out. I think it came out in 43. Did you turn
to
that?
I used it chiefly for references. It was very helpful at that time for bibliographical aid. But I don't recall consulting the chapters particularly. I know I read it. But I had the back recall that the medical library work was all that different
at that time.
But I do think experience in a larger institution is very helpful as an introduction, because you know of things that aren't in your own collection.
There were no classes in medical library for medical physiology.
Well, there were lectures. Different people had given lectures, and I used to give lectures to the freshmen. But freshmen are at a very much preoccupied with their anatomy and their basic sciences, and they haven't seen Colleague yet for library resources. It seems to me that you usually get just a part of your attention at best, even if it's a required course. If it isn't required, you don't have a very large group
at all. Yeah. When you first came in those early years, did you encounter any problems because of the fact that you were a woman in a kind of a typical male medical school?
I wasn't conscious of that. I think in the administration I was accepted as capable in my field. And that is another thing that kept me at Wisconsin. I don't think you could find a more congenial environment. People are hired to do a job, and they're given the freedom to do the job. I never had the feeling of administrative pressure. If the faculty wanted anything, they told us. There was an easy interchange. Our faculty library committee did not, for instance, pass on book on separate books, but they did like to examine the journal titles before we subscribed, and I was very glad to have faculty input on that. But the freedom to experiment, to try new things, whether they'd been done before or not, was always there.
Would you like to take a break and get a cup of coffee? Okay. Returning from our cup of coffee, I'd like to begin asking you some personal questions. Two areas of questions actually were brought to mind by sitting downstairs in your old office now, Virginia Holt's office. One having to do with personal questions and women in the profession, and also the medical library service where she started out. So I think first I'll do the personal questions. First of all, I did find reference to mention of a protracted illness, and I wasn't, you know, I have no idea what that was, and I didn't know whether it was something that would be relevant to your work in Emily or the library or not.
Well, I'd say it's very relevant, because I had an advanced cancer in the colon. At the time, this was in January 1961, I had surgery, and 1 month later, I went on to 5-FU. Which was invented by Dr. Heidelberger of the Cardinal Cancer Research Laboratory just across the way.
What in what? 5-FU?
5-fluorouridate.
Oh, okay.
She's one of the basic cancer antagonists. It was still highly experimental, but it was felt that a lethal disease deserved a dangerous remedy. It was highly toxic, and I reacted with everything I had. But I was on treatment for 1 month between treatments for 3.5 years, and it got to be very wearing. So they suggested that the second book, I had found nothing wrong.
Uh-huh.
The first surgery night was in 1961, and when I think of everything that happened after that, building, planning. As a matter of fact, when I was on treatment, I remember many occasions when the last thing I wanted to do was go in and discuss chairs for the library. But I had the feeling then that anything good that happened to me, I had paid for in advance.
Oh, that's a good philosophy. But you weren't on leave then. You continued your job.
I was out of him for several weeks. And then at the time of the Seattle meeting, I'd had a little relapse, and I actually got out of bed to go take the plane to Seattle.
Yeah. Were you on the, those were the years you were on the board?
Were you at
was
safety
I
block?
That year?
I know I went in for surgery just about the time of the board meeting in January of 61. And I remember Bob Lentz writing, I mean, that was at the time of the decision on the central, the opening of the central office. He wrote to say that he hoped that my opening was as successful as theirs.
Oh.
How delightful. As a matter of fact, a few years later, he went through the same thing, and we both survived pretty well. But when I think of everything that's happened since then, the like residency and the Sotheby's sales, I have a great deal to be grateful to Wisconsin for, because they persevered with this treatment, even though they knew it was highly toxic. And whether that can take the credit or not, at least I survived.
Uh-huh.
And if I was 1 in 1,100, it makes a difference to be that one and not one of the 1099.
Yes, I think it made a difference. There are quite a lot of people in
Dr.
life.
Dr. Ben Potter, who's chairman of our library committee and our building committee, commented that at that time, Madison was the best place in the world to have cancer. Because, and I know for several years, when I went to meetings, I'd have to have treatment at various centers. The only doctor who knew anything about this, about cancer chemotherapy, was out in Estes Park. He said, cribiasin. But it shows how slow these things are sometimes in getting into general currency.
Well, that's just amazing. Another kind of personal question. I wanted to ask about marriage, because certainly it seems, I think, to people entering the profession today, the library directors and past MLA presidents, a large percentage of them have been unmarried women. And I was curious to know if you had deliberately chosen to set out to be a career woman, and do you think that was the...
No, it just happened. I think I would have been very particular about marriage. I'm rather a perfectionist in some way, in some things, and if I interested in that, who said between he and me, he and I don't think I could afford it. And so it wasn't that it was a choice between more or less perfection on one side and perfection on the other. It was not a deliberate choice. I'm sure if the right marriage had appeared on the horizon, that would have been the choice. But I believe, certainly in the early years, it was a kind of either-or thing. You had to accept it. Second position. And I don't see how I could have done what I did with any other responsibilities, because my professional responsibilities, the extra time, the building, planning, the committees, all of these activities would have been physically more than I could have handled.
Uh-huh.
And you're investing not only your time and energy, but your psychic energy.
Yes.
And it's pretty hard to be devoted to one thing at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Your first devotion.
Yeah. You're dead right about the psychic energy. I think that's very, very crucial.
I found all the way through that I can't concentrate on three different things at once. I have a way of putting things on the track. Until I get one boxcar off the track, I can't think about the next problem. This is a problem in administration to be able to handle. Everything pushing a little bit instead of concentrating on one thing and then concentrating on the next. It makes for a kind of zigzag administration, which isn't the best thing. But again, this is part of your psychic involvement.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think Women's Lib has made a difference, or do you think it will still be?
Well, Wisconsin was on the examination list about the time I lived here. One of the last things I did was to set up a schedule of salaries. I think the average was between $2,000 and $3,000 under the salaries of comparable people in the university I served.
Uh-huh.
And most of their high-level people were men.
Are men.
Yeah. And I would stack our staff capability up with theirs, with the staff at any other library on campus. I don't believe that is fully redressed yet, but surveillance goes, there's been some threat of disappointed candidates of bringing a claim because men don't have an adequate chance in this building, but we do have quite a number of male staff members. Kept it in mind that ability is the important thing.
In your years as an administrator, have you noticed among the women that worked for you that those that were unmarried were able to devote more energy, especially psychic energy, to their job?
Yes, I don't think there's much doubt of it. So if you have a young child, obviously that takes precedent. I have all found that all the years I've been working in libraries that the professional people, I don't put it, they're healthier than the others, but they have enough commitment that they go to work whether they feel like it or not, whereas secretaries and typists don't always have that
commitment. One of the things you mentioned earlier was the director of the program in Chicago acting as a mentor, guiding you toward Wisconsin. And I understand that you played that role for Virginia Holtz in her.
Yes, one of my best friends on campus was the director of the library school. She used to be good candidates to us. We had student assistants in a number of departments. So Virginia came in as a assistant in our extension service. And then at the end of the first semester, the woman in charge retired. Virginia carried that full time for the rest of the year.
While she was still in library.
She was still in library school. So we were able to get her position jacked up somewhat, and her classification improved early because of this excellent experience and ability. So by being able to reward her in advance of any other offers, is one way we'd be able to hold her here.
So in a way, you really had the what you could call an old girls' network going here with the woman at the library school.
And we have sent out a number of medical librarians from this library. Former staff member was in the Arizona Medical Center. One is now at the American Dental Association.
Oh, it's the name of the lady over in the library school.
Rachel Shank.
Oh,
and she had been a classmate of mine at Chicago.
Chicago.
We lived at International House. We used to play bridge together. So she came up here a few months after I did.
I see. Okay. While we were mentioning Virginia Holtz again, and you said she had taken over the service, the medical library service. Now, I've been reading about that. I know you've been interested in it because you've got a couple of articles on it. But I guess I didn't realize it was separate from the library when you came here?
No. Well, it started out as a service jointly between University Extension and the medical school. But eventually the Extension gave up any contribution. We received the review books and exchange journals from the Wisconsin Medical Journal. That was the sole contribution of the State Medical Association. So here we were with three staff members, and one of them pretty much devoted herself to that. Well, it seemed to me that if we could do it with our rather limited resources, any library in the country could have made some effort at it. But I found there were very few of these. One was the state-supported medical library in New York. The other is at Iowa. Ours was really the only organized service under a medical school. So, when I can't find any information, I collected. I sent out a brief questionnaire and found that there was very little of this kind of service.
And this was the report then you made at the 1948
and
1980.
And I suggested that I gave this report. It was on a very hot day at Philadelphia. Up in the 90s. science, and nobody was interested. So I gave this report full of carefully selected statistics, and I almost went to sleep myself, as well as the rest of the audience. That article was published to the Bulletin and sank without a trace. I don't think I even had a request for it, except from a library down in Brazil.
I think we're at the end of our tape here. We better stop right at that. Why was it you think that there was this lack of interest?
I think they were completely preoccupied with their own responsibilities. They had staff, not enough money to do what they needed to be done locally, and they couldn't continue to get this for this plan. They couldn't continue expanding their school. Of course, a great many of the private schools felt some responsibility for their alumni. But it was not highly organized. We didn't. This was not only pre-Xerox, it was pre-Verifax.
Uh-huh.
And material had to be met on an interlibrary loan basis.
And this was that unbound duplicates collection?
Yes, so we had an unbound duplicate collection of journals, which were the state, mostly the state journals, but we also duplicated the basic. It served most of the needs of the borrowers. So here we were, limping along. We couldn't give as prompt service as we might be able to do now, but Dr. Middleton and the other, Dr. Bardeen before him, felt that this was important enough that it was worth the investment. I'm sure it was responsible for our alumni support that got us this building, because the profession, not only our graduates, but other medical people in the state appreciated what was done for them.
Uh-huh.
Ashland, Wisconsin, I don't know if it's on, they didn't have much in the way of library. The ability to borrow from Edison has been a strong source of all kinds of support to us here. We have a preceptor system, too, that these people had to keep up.
In those early years, Milwaukee was the only other place with a medical library.
Milwaukee took care of, Marquette took care of that urban strip around Milwaukee, which is the ocean. And Milwaukee, they took care of the rest of the state. Now, Illinois had very slow extension development because everybody relied on AMA.
Yes.
This is not helping. It's not keeping, not investing support in your own, investing money into your own.
Well, there's been a huge spurt of interest now in this service to the rural physician in recent years. Could you comment on why it was this idea has come into its
own? Well, I think they developed a meeting after the Bloomquist Report and the National Library of Medicine and promotion. There came a point where they began to recognize
the Bloomquist Report?
Yes, Al Bloomquist from Harvard sent out. Studied the status of medical libraries in relation particularly to this increase in research support and research activities.
Okay.
And included that in the General Medical Education.
Okay.
Back in 19. Reference here. Well, Bloomquist also, but Scott Adams really did the report on medical library services and their development, Journal of Medical Education, 1963.
Okay.
So this is a very recent development.
Uh-huh. And so that report was very influential then.
Oh, I'm sure it was. I heard that one thing, it was published in the Journal of the Faith and Education. And for another thing, National Library of Medicine recognized this need and promoted, and they had to figure out legislators. Executives who could help with it. And of course, as soon as there was money to be sniffed in the office, it was all of a sudden discovered that we could do something.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Many of us had discovered that we had been doing at that time for 30 years.
And again, I had a question here about Forum Follows funding. Do you think the availability of that grant money obviously had a big impact? Do you think it was people just jumping on the bandwagon? Are they going to drop it when the money goes?
No, I can't see that. Because they find that it was, for one thing, we have mechanical aids that we didn't have then. And more of it can be done on a clerical basis than on a professional basis. Because it's computer tapes do for all of us what we don't have to do for ourselves. Most libraries that time had some sort of an index of important articles or an index of reference questions answered. And many of them actually indexed or advanced the next medicus. They did a great deal of duplicating work. And
perhaps
services for the
years had no idea.
And so the reference services were very important, had to be professional.
Your extension service, which I assume still must be continuing, how does it relate to the regional medical library?
Well, for a while, that's when the regional medical library was established in Chicago. The academic institutions represented on the council felt very first in Indianapolis, and Mary Jane Platts was a tremendous volume of loans that were not reimbursed, that were sent out by all these state medical school libraries, uh-huh. which had extension services. And I'm sure that had quite an influence on the accounting at the regional. We were getting no funding at all for this service. And now there is a kind of board system. This all the accounting methods came in after all this. Systems drain off a great volume of the more commonplace loans. They don't have to go to Chicago or don't have to go out to Indiana.
So, probably the level of service to the rural physician hasn't changed much. All the changes that have been
well,
in your
the changes that have been, we prided ourselves on having this long time service. We used to have exhibits at the State Medical Association meetings. But when we came to send out consultant librarians, to the communities to advise the hospital library on development or staff or handling of cataloging and this kind of thing. We were very much chagrined to find how many areas didn't even know the service existed.
Oh.
So that personal consultation was a very important element, and it has been continued ever since.
It increased then?
Yes,
the number of people you served.
Well, I think when I left, it was something like 70,000 a year. On and on, I've had 70,000 as our circulation over the medical school library desk. But it's increased about tenfold.
So the regional medical library program has
helped. Yes, it has helped a great deal. We always, it's a great deal easier to expand service than to reduce it. While we were in the old building, we always did charge for the xeroxing, as we felt that we gave free xeroxing, which is very often the tip that's offered to the borrower. It would be very hard to back up. Well, the reason you had is you had to back up. And the physicians, the local libraries that we asked, they didn't object to the charge for xeroxing and so on. Their great need was more support from your own administrations, more budget support, secretarial support, space, and all of this. That the money was there for the service, but it was from the individual physician. They didn't object to paying for xeroxing. So we've always proceeded on the basis of providing services that they can't get.
You mentioned that the move to the new building enabled you to expand that particular service. I wanted to ask you some more questions about that new building, since you mentioned earlier all the numbers of years you'd spent on various remodelings and buildings. A lot of people were building new libraries during that kind of boom period, and I was curious, were your problems typical of those other libraries too, do you think?
Well, I know great many of them got federal funds. We finally gave up on that and went ahead without.
Oh, so yours was built without federal funds?
Without federal funds. It kept being deferred. And if we had had to wait another 6 months, there would have been a loud pop. The whole place would have been so terribly jammed. At that time, we felt it was time again for.
coffee break that when you first came, there was no budget.
With no road, with no budget. I had no statistics. I didn't know how many volumes we added. I remember keeping a record of that first 6 months or so, 1,600 volumes.
So when you were writing the early budgets, were you turning them into the medical school?
I didn't. The first one was compiled by the prepared by the superintendent of the hospital.
That must have been interesting.
Yes, it was a very odd distribution.
But then you just mentioned that you got the budget back from the Memorial Library.
Yes, the book budget.
Somewhere along the line,
yes,
that part had switched.
That was switched over, and then the medical school had always provided the personnel and all the space and all our pencils and typewriters for the medical school.
But the book budget came through the library.
And so the library committee asked for consultant. Consultant with the main library, so Louise Darling came to serve as our consultant and recommended that we were very definitely of a size and at a stage where we should have control of our operations. We felt that as long as we had the specialists here to do reference work and so on, that we could, and we had the necessary reference tools, that we could probably do a better job of the process.
We were in a new building then,
yes,
when Louise Darling came.
And with great effort, I managed to hold out for enough workspace so that we were able to take it over without too much congestion.
So that was another service that your new building allowed you to expand. Did you talk a lot with the other librarians who were building then about various features?
I visited buildings, not on a special tour, but never. I visit the building to talk with them and get their advice on space and equipment.
What kind of things work?
Yes.
How is your library different than those you visited?
Well, it's a very receptive library. I can remember when Sam Hitt visited us. He said that you have. I've been in enough libraries that I know when I first step into a building whether this is a place where nice things happen. And that's one of the nice things. Tranquil building. One of its great virtues, I think, is the traffic arrangement, so that every corridor serves two purposes.
Mm-hmm.
Offices on one side, stacks on the other. It's visibly a library the moment you step in.
Mm-hmm.
It has windows for the soul, all the reading rooms are on the window side, but the staff also have windows. I'm very strong on longest time in the library, you have the right to
look out.
At least equal facilities.
Yes.
Practically, one can go from, say, the card catalog on one side or the reading space. There's very little cross traffic. It's proved to be quite a flexible building because it doesn't have too many walls. The walls have been put up since. Subdivide and add more offices. But nothing's had to be added that we didn't know would have to be added. I was Virginia Holtz and I worked together on it. And at the time I said it would be adequate for about 6 years.
Uh-huh.
That has been proved true. We're bulging at the seams right now.
Your central core was also an innovative idea for libraries, wasn't it?
Well, I think it was certainly fashionable. The central core with all the water going down the middle with very little access, and very little possibility for the water to flood in the book space, the elevator, and the all the facilities go up the middle.
The main electrical.
So we were able to get away with just one elevator right around the corner for processing. One thing I'm proud of is the little area just outside the librarian's office and processing,
mm-hmm.
and close to the public services for the acquisition, bibliography, the books in print, and all of that, paraphernalia. what was looking up a book and accumulate a book index.
Mm-hmm.
Put it there where they get at it.
Oh, of course, I never thought of that. You're right. We lock ours up, too.
Yeah. Right. And we changed immediately to an ALM classification.
Mm-hmm.
There's a certain virtue in changing classification in the ALM. The main library had changed from Cutter to Library of Congress. And Cutter was so happy that the classifiers spent most of their time trying to find which inappropriate place to put a book.
What, was yours Cutter previously also?
Oh, it's been Library of Congress for 10 years. So we have this big section of older books, which have moved up in the historical section, in the Library of Congress section, a good deal of which is would still be there because a book on education or bacteriology or biology would be in that section. And then the NLM. So we'd be able to use an NLM copy. Subject catalog from reverse filing so that the latest books are first behind subject cards so we don't have any type of the subject date. That is extremely useful in science.
What you don't have to do that?
Well, for instance, a book on appendix. You find the latest book filed first, and the Fritz's book may be back here.
Okay. Not, you don't mean just additions.
No.
You mean the actual.
Actual reverse order ID. So that I was asked one time for the treatment of typhoid fever about 1920. I just looked at a book published in 1920. It is dangerous if anything's misfiled. It'll never be found again. Not in alphabetical or chronological.
Was this your own idea, or is I have never heard of it before.
It's used, I think Colorado used that.
And that would that have been Frank Rogers?
No.
No,
that's
was
before
that,
he went there.
That was before then. What year was it that you moved into this building?
It was, we actually only moved about the early part of 66.
So
we moved reserves and historical collection over here.
So then it was about 66 when you changed from the LC to NLM and began this new filing.
And I've worked out a very good system for the transition. Virginia and the associate library and the main library were a committee to the plan.
What was Virginia's position here in the
library? She was the associate library.
Right, okay.
And in charge of reference. So they had elaborate flow charts and plans.
I've heard people remark on the difficulty of working with architects in building libraries. Did you experience it?
Well, our difficulty was with the university architect. Because I think basically he distrusted the ability of a woman to plan a building.
Uh-huh.
And they distrusted my figures. We really fought to for workspace.
Uh-huh.
And I thought they interfered with matters that were really a professional concern, not just architecture.
Uh-huh.
all over, and I believe our plan was not as functional as it could be. We decided to spend all the money necessary to get all the building we could,
mm-hmm.
and we left other matter of equipment and so on a bit more up in the air, because the building is the most permanent. Other things can be
added later.
But we didn't sacrifice beauty to economy. The University Architect's Office, the designers over there, were very much convinced of the need for quality, especially if you only contributed by alumni.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very easy, for instance, to buy a sturdy chair that's clunky, but buy a kind of sturdy chair that is graceful is another matter.
Mm-hmm.
Every chair in this building is upholstered. We had nursing students and 6-foot medical students. We had all of them try our chairs.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's a very welcome and comfortable library.
Was this when you became particularly interested in equipment?
Yes.
Did this, the course you taught,
I was asked to
come out of that?
We were beginning to think of planning, although we haven't got very far on equipment. That course was rather peculiar. I was told for it. It was quite a miscellany. I remember Gertrude Bannon when it was in it, but then there were some little hospital library, and so the range of background in a continuation course at that time was even more expensive than it is now. I think now some of them are earmarked for people who have had preceding courses,
mm-hmm.
or for large institutions or small institutions. But I can remember telling the story of the previous director of the library school had been talking about the need to buy good equipment.
Mm-hmm.
He said that when you open your desk, said there's nothing worse than pulling and tugging in tight drawers. Well, I told that story, and there was not a glimmer from the group. And I thought, well, I'm in the wrong place.
Wait here.
But I did have the Canadian Library, Hospital Library, and say that my advice had been crucial to her. It was something to do with buying typewriters, so I think some people
profited.
One doesn't always know what that pebble dropped in the brook is going to get.
Did your participation in the medical school libraries group, they had a panel on planning a better medical school library. Did that evolve out of your experience in building this book?
Well, yes, I was asked to be on the panel because I had been busy on it. And Val Vester Quest organized that panel too.
Uh-huh.
And he was a consultant for our building.
Oh, he was a consultant for your building too.
Uh-huh.
You also had a chapter on the pursuit of flexibility. That too, I imagine, grew out of your experience.
That reflected also some of I think every field has evidence of its predecessor in the emphasis given to certain aspects. If you've had very short space, a new building won't be much more adequate space. So there's a kind of reaction there against your previous restriction.
Another of your articles was on centralization versus decentralization. Now, I assume this also grew out of your experience,
yes.
of becoming independent from the main library?
I thought that there was practically nothing written about it. Deborah Jordan did her article on many years before had queried some people, but there were actually very few figures about what went on. So I sent out this very, very simple question about whether they were organized, whether they had control of budget processing, ordering, and so on. And I got practically 100% response, which indicated the interest in the country.
Everyone,
and
having
I think actually
problem,
that
yeah.
is my most influential article. A number of people have told me that it was either assisted or was crucial in getting their own independence.
Uh-huh.
And at that time, there was a university library that commented that he didn't know any decentralized libraries, and I couldn't contradict him in a public meeting, but I was appalled to find that there was so little knowledge, and particularly since there's been this great development of the internal work, the cat lines, and all of these. Because that we would just not have plugged into the right system if we remained under the library. And if we hadn't made these changes when we did, it would have been a tremendous job to turn around, for instance, to change your classification again. With the computer system. I lost the name.
You mean our midline?
Yes, midline and those other services.
And the whole University of Wisconsin belongs to some kind of a regional library network, too, doesn't it?
There are several layers in the state university system. They all belong to a common library, and so these institutes belong to a council. There is also a reference network, whereas they support a staff member to come in and do reference services from the different libraries on campus and send the material. We send ours out direct, but a public library, for instance, might ask for something that's over here. It might be rooted to the searcher. But in general, we deal directly with libraries as well as individuals.
Now that the libraries are using OCLC, and they're working on the authority files. I mean, you are in their union catalog at the main library here, but you use different subject headings.
Yeah.
This isn't going to cause a problem?
The subject headings are going to cards that are longer sent over. I'm not used to
just
sure
the main
about that. That goes back 10, 12 years, and I've forgotten the details.
I guess I was thinking in terms of, is that centralization versus a continuing problem, one that you have to keep fighting because they keep trying to absorb you back into there.
No, I wouldn't say it works that way. Unless I know one institution, the university library, it was bound because they could be ready to get medical school in. And it did temporarily, but the medical school faculty bought it and finally back on the
independent.
No, I think the main library is usually like that. It's such a relief not to have it. Not so much women to put in the libraries, that they can use the libraries for their own personal purposes. And we've always had a very cooperative basis with all the department and division libraries on campus. But it was simply essential for the health of this library
to
become a unified being.
Note that several of the articles that we've been talking about, the building and extension of decentralization, have grown out of your administrative experiences. And you did mention that a lot of your articles were occasional articles. Does this reflect some of your philosophy, the purposes of the library literature?
No, it simply reflects events. I think without a deadline, it's very hard to get yourself down and write something that you think needs to be written. This latest paper on library ethics was a matter of selection. Beatrice Romeo asked me to come up to her regional meeting in Hamilton and let me select the topic. This was the topic that selected me because it concerned work for many years. I'm at a period where I can afford to stick my neck out without endangering my future reputation. It was a pleasure to be a little old-fashioned and return to some of the bases of the basic philosophy.
history of medicine had just completed its meeting, and I met Dr. Singer. Dr. Singer is today my own brother. Mm-hmm. I'm rather sorry that the meetings are no longer ridiculous, because one does miss that, that relationship with a sister organization. I don't remember too much of the detail of that meeting, but I do remember that as I came into Madison on a train, because they don't have trains, I decided I was a Midwesterner and I would remain a Midwesterner.
That's an interesting thing to bring home from the meeting.
There was the feeling, you know, that the air in the East has been breathed by too many people.
What did you feel that there was? You mentioned that you were warmly welcomed at the meeting, but did you feel that there was an Eastern kind of clique in the association that ran things and made it difficult to break in?
I think that was definitely true, although a couple of years after that, the Metropolitan Chairman of the Nominating Committee asked me to, and my niece was on the secretary. Well, I am a very bad secretary, and besides, I just couldn't take the time.
Uh-huh.
So it was still geographical education. But I think that the thing that has rubbed a good many of us out here during the years of development of the regional system was this habit of consulting with certain institutions, with Harvard and with Yale, and perhaps we can talk about it. They never did do it so much. But there was a feeling that certain people were called on, and that there were other people.
So being from the Midwest was in a way a problem.
But of course there is a very strong Chicago, very strong Chicago, active Chicago group. So I would say that it was more an intangible, more feeling than anything else. But of course they have the tremendous resources of the libraries and colleges.
Well, when you first gave a paper at only your third meeting, and you wanted a committee right after that?
Second
meeting?
Oh, well, I suggested to Janet Doe that we, as the formation of an extension committee to promote this, well, I couldn't get any hold on it. Nobody was enough interested in some of the hospital funds in this world. Very much concerned with the issue of medical school teachers, and they couldn't care less about the doctor in a little town in the upper peninsula. I think Minnesota was rather self-centered at that time, highly centralized.
librarian.
Well, nobody ever asked me to join this individual. And sometimes there wasn't a discussion of it when I joined this. I remember Helen Bain, who was at Long Island, coming to meetings for years before I did, and she had never been the first one. So we went in, I think, the same year.
Do you think that was influenced by that change in the bylaws requiring that the officers be professional librarians rather than MDs? And how long was that?
I don't believe it had anything to do with it.
It seems that that was when the association began
this
its professional
relations. This was a very crucial period of time. Professional librarians were beginning to gather a little restive, I think. Also, their interests were more professional, and probably the doctors felt less at home.
Did you sense this as a new member? Something that you just kind of recollect looking back?
I recollect there were some quite famous names, of course, on the rolls, but I don't recall very many doctors that practically none. And Dr. Middleton kept up his membership for years. He was an honorary.
Yes. I was going to ask you if you had an honorary. That was in 1961, I think, was it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that was the meeting I attended. My hair had to grow back, and I was wearing it. And I think I realized that was a great shock to people because I didn't think this was just almost after my surgery.
I see, and the treatment was affecting your hair.
And that was the very famous meeting in Seattle where the boat we took out for dinner got stuck waiting for permit to go through the locks. We sat out there until midnight.
Oh dear.
And here I was with my hip bone sticking between my skin and sitting for
hours. Oh, great discomfort, I can imagine.
A story that nobody has heard. Marion Robinson at that time was placement advisor. She hadn't gone on this famous tour, but when we didn't come back, hadn't come back by midnight, she was almost ready to call out the Coast Guard. But she couldn't help the sneaking idea that if that ship had gone down, there would awful lot of good positions available.
Oh, marvelous. Her work as placement officer would really pick up, then.